My life. Amazing. My life.
My life.
Amazing.
My life.
My life.
With
amazing.
My life.
Amazing strangers.
Hello to you, wherever you are in the world, listening to episode number 8 of My Life with Amazing Strangers. My name's Gary Robinson, and I've got to say she's no stranger, I have to say. She's a fantastic friend, great pal of mine, and we've known each other for many years, and it's great to have her back on yet another Fierce Curiosity podcast. Suzanne Zeedyke, Dr. Suzanne Zeedyke, hot back from the Emerald Isle. You were in Limerick. Can you share what you were doing over there?
Gary, it's lovely to be back, and I'm very excited about the conversation that we're going to have tonight with our guests. And it's true, I am just back from Ireland, where we were talking about the importance of connection and about the efforts that are being made there for people to become more trauma-informed, and about the ways in which care has improved there in Ireland, as well as here in Scotland. And so it really had me thinking how the stories that we tell have really wide application and help us to think about children around the world. These stories that people are willing to share bring that to life gloriously.
Done the just. And extremely powerful stories are coming out in this series, very powerful, and giving us as presenters and our guests and our audience an awful lot to think about in terms of care in the UK. So I'll just hand over to you and off you go, and I'll speak to you shortly.
Great. Well, welcome to all our listeners who are here to think in more depth about fierce curiosity, which is needed when we have to think about things where ordinary levels of curiosity will not do. When we have to think about things that are sore and uncomfortable, sometimes threatening, sometimes that make us feel guilty. And if we are able and willing to step up to those uncomfortable questions, we can think about what children need and about the times when we didn't meet children's needs. So fierce curiosity is when you need extra deep levels of curiosity, really fierce levels, in order to think about where we have missed children's care, where things have got better, and where we need to not take things for granted. So tonight, we're going to explore another set of stories about that. And tonight, we're going to children's hospitals. Because there was once a time in which we didn't meet children's emotional needs in hospitals, but now we've got much better at doing that. And so if we can hear those stories, we can think about how that changed, occurred, and what we need to pay really close attention to in today's world. So tonight, we have with us our guests, Shelley Gray, whose daughter Rosa has been in hospital recently, and she has lots of insights to share about what that experience was like. And we have Pete Kinnear, who was in hospital when he was young, when he was 4 and when he was 7, in the early 1950s. When the care that he experienced and his parents experienced was very different from the kind of care that Shelley and Rosa will have experienced now. So can I begin by saying thank you. Welcome to both of you. I'm so glad you're here. What made you want to come?
Well, thank you so much for having me join the conversation. Hospital has been a reasonably kind of big part of Rosa's life, although obviously not everything is perfect. There's been a huge amount that's been immensely positive about our experiences in terms of how we have been cared for. So I think because of our experiences, I feel like it just the issue of how we do support children and families through what's immensely difficult times is just really important. And I'm really just grateful to be part of the conversation and to reflect on, you know, how things used to be, which I think are very radically different from where thankfully we've got to now. And I'm sure we have further to go as well. So thank you.
Shelley, thank you so much for coming and sharing your story tonight. Pete, what made you want to come along tonight? This is the first time you've shared this story of your childhood quite so publicly, isn't it?
It is, but you and I have been talking about this story for the last 12 years. And it's only over that time that I've gradually understood the significance of what I went through and why it might have actually affected my life in so many ways.
Pete, thank you so much for coming and agreeing to share your story more widely with the public. So we're going to come back to you very shortly, but let's start with Shelley. Shelley, you have a beautiful daughter, Rosa. She's been in and out of hospital since she was quite young, and you had a really longer stay in hospital when she was five. Would you just tell us about your experience, about the kind of care that you experienced in hospital? What was that like for your family?
So Rosa, as you said, has been kind of in and out of hospital a fair bit over her life, and we've had a couple of kind of, or three longer stays in amongst all of that. But the most recent time started just at the end of 2022. Yeah, sorry, I get the years, I'm thinking, which year is it? 2022.
Sure.
Over the turn of the year into 2023. So she was in for 7 weeks in total, and then she was back and forth a lot then for outpatient appointments and so on. And she pretty much managed to make use of the various different bits of the hospital. So she was in accident and emergency, critical care, theatre quite a few times, ICU for a couple of weeks, and medical ward, and then the kind of ward you go into just before you get out. So she kind of, yeah, made quite extensive use of the facilities available. So, I mean, it was an immensely traumatic experience. She was incredibly unwell. So for our whole family, it was hugely traumatic, incredibly, incredibly difficult. The way that she was cared for and we were supported, though, was just really impressive, to be honest. I mean, you know, there was the odd, you know, moment that wasn't great, but overall, I think two things probably. One, she was in the Sick Kids in Edinburgh, and that's a very new building, and that's been designed with very much the well-being of children and families in mind. So the whole way that the hospital is designed is to be a welcoming place for children. So I think just that sort of thoughtful design, and I think children and young people and parents were probably involved in the design of it.
Okay.
On the ward, there was a play specialist nurse, which was just brilliant. So they had a playroom on each of the wards that she was at, not ICU, but the other wards, and a play specialist. So even when she was fairly immobile and sort of in bed and so on, the play specialist would kind of offer to come and just kind of support her to access some kind of play or engagement or that type of thing, which was brilliant for her. And a kind of, you know, that's the sort of normal stuff of being a child that she was missing.
Shelley,
sorry.
It's great. Shelley, can I ask, were you able to stay with her?
So some of the time we were and some we weren't. And actually this has been, I was thinking about this because obviously of what I know of Pete's experience and hear more shortly, but I was thinking about this because one of the hardest bits when Rosa's been in hospital is when she's been in critical care, because you can't stay with her. So you have to go home and leave her, you know, in the care of the staff. And that's always really, really difficult, because you just, you know, you feel so far apart. It just doesn't feel like a natural thing to be parted from your child, especially when they're unwell and they need you.
Shelley, when you had to go home and leave her in ICU, when could you come back next to see her?
Well, that's the I guess the good side is that it's not like there's kind of set visiting hours. So in ICU, you know, it's a practicality that they can't have you staying bedside. But within that constraint, I think, you know, there is a lot of appreciation of how important it is that you're still the parent. And it's, I do remember, particularly when she was a baby, actually, and she was in neonatal ICU, you feel quite, you sometimes sort of don't feel like a parent in the same way, because so little is in your control. So you feel like you can't do anything with your baby or your child without sort of permission from the staff. And I think there's now more of an understanding of that from, you know, particularly the nurses, actually. So when she was very unwell this time and in ICU, the other thing that we were incredibly lucky was that we had a room in the hotel in the hospital that's there for parents, which, again, is just a hugely, a huge support, actually. It makes a massive, massive difference.
Just the way you're describing things is really helpful to people who may have no experience of children's hospitals. So they may have no idea what they're like now and what they used to be like. And in just a second, we're going to come to Pete's story. But can I ask you two more things? First, when Rosa wasn't in ICU, were you able to stay with her much more of the time? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, so when she was not in ICU, yeah, absolutely. And again, the design of the hospital, because it's a modern, recently built hospital, it was designed very much for parents to be there and parent their child and care for their child. So there's pull-down beds. So next to Rosa's bed, there's a pull-down parent's bed. So you're, you know, right there. And that makes a huge difference. And again, you can come and go, you know, you can be there whatever times you want to be there, and so on. So yeah, you can be absolutely with your child.
That's a great description. Let me ask one more thing. Could Rosa keep her teddy with her when she went into hospital?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, her bed, even in ICU, her bed was full of teddies. And I remember when she was in ICU, she has this knitted Gruffalo, which I was looking at thinking, this is one of her favourite things and I really want to bring it in, but it looks like probably the most unhygienic item. And so I asked the charge nurse whether we were allowed to bring this Gruffalo in, and they said, yes, of course you are. So yes, absolutely. Her bed was full of teddies.
I love the way you said that. Yes, of course you are. Because it's so clear and it sounds like things that we can rest confidently in. So with that story, Pete, could I come to you? I'm going to guess that the story that Shelley is sharing of Rosa's stay in hospital, right up to 5, which sounds really different from when you were in hospital in the early 1950s, when you were 4, and then again when you were 7. Am I right? Does it sound very different?
It's a different world entirely. If I start with the first thing, well, all I can tell you in terms of dates, it was before I started infant school. So I would guess I was 4, maybe 4 and a half. So that would put it about 1951. And I was not alone. What happened was my sister and I were both put into an isolation hospital because we had chickenpox. Now, at the time, that was unusual. You didn't go to hospital with chickenpox. No. You didn't go to hospital with measles or lots of other things. You normally went round to another family that already had that in their children and got it as well. So our circumstances were rather odd. And I think the context of why that happened is probably very important. But at the time, you just do what your mother says. So we went to hospital. It was an isolation hospital. And as we went in, my mother said, your job is to look after your sister. So that's me. I've got a job to do. And so that's my job. That's fine. So the moment my mother left, we were separated, and I was marched one way and my sister went off in another direction. And this was not according to script, really. This is not what I was expecting. And I had no idea where she was. We were putting rooms which were isolation rooms. So there was nobody else in there, wasn't sharing a room or a dormitory. And when I woke up the next morning, I sat up in bed and I realized there was a big plate glass between my room and the room which is immediately next to it. And it was somebody in the other room. It was my sister. I found my sister. And they were soundproof, so you couldn't actually talk to each other, but I could knock on the glass and then we could hold up our hands against the glass and touch. So I could still keep an eye on my sister, which was great. Several days later, my sister disappeared. And I was in a state of panic because I'm supposed to look after my sister. It's my job. So I asked one of the nurses when she came in, "Where is my sister Anne?" And I was told, "You don't have a sister Anne." And I insisted that I come in with my sister Anne and I had to look after her. They said, "You don't have a sister Anne. Your sister is called Sandra." Well, I'd never heard this name. I had no idea who Sandra was. I didn't know at that time that my sister was christened Sandra Anne. But we never used the first name. So I didn't even know it was her name. So for 2 days or so, I created absolute havoc, scrounging. I want my sister. I want my sister. I want to see my sister. And eventually, they relented and they let me come out of my room and look down a corridor. And there was a little girl there. And they said, "Here is your sister, Sandra." And I said, "I don't have a sister, Sandra." Anyway, I formed the impression that my sister had been abducted. And when my mother came back, probably at the weekend, I said, "They've abducted Anne and they've replaced her." And my sister finds it hilarious, the fact that I always insisted when we came out that I'd lost my sister and we got a replacement. My sister found that amusing. I never found it amusing. And I couldn't believe that we were fobbed off with this girl called Sandra.
So, Pete,
Yes.
can I give back to you key elements of the story that you just told us? Because I'm also watching on this Zoom screen Shelley's face. And I'm grateful. I'm going to come back to Shelley in a moment to ask her what it feels like to hear that story. But let's just remind ourselves of what Pete just told us. He's a 4-year-old. He's been asked by his mother to take care of his younger sister. And then the staff take away his sister, and he doesn't know where. And when finally he can see her, he can't talk to her. But nobody's explaining to him what's happening. His mother isn't there. Nobody who is familiar is there. And when he creates enough of a ruckus that they finally relent to show this irritating child who will not be quiet where his sister is, he doesn't really recognize his sister anymore because now she's got this confusing set of names. Pete, am I right? Does that describe your story?
I didn't believe that the person that they showed me as my sister was her. I actually didn't believe it.
And when you came home from hospital, finally, how long were you in hospital that time?
Well, I've been trying to work that out. I think at maximum, probably 2 weeks.
So you were in hospital for 2 weeks. Did you see your mother during that time?
Well, my mother was only allowed to visit on a Saturday for 2 hours. So that would have been after she took us in one the next Saturday, and then again when she took us home at the end of the 2 weeks. So I would have seen my mother for 2 weeks, so for 2 hours in 2 weeks.
Having lost your sister
My
and having
sister, by the way, had a wonderful time because she was a lovely little girl, and all the nurses doted on her, and she wasn't any problem, whereas I was a stroppy little brat, really.
And do you, Pete, let me ask two more questions before we come back to you, Shelley. Pete, what is your strongest memory of that whole time as a four-year-old in the earliest 50s? If you look back now from your late 70s, what is your strongest memory now?
It's the rediscovery of my sister when we could put our hands on the glass.
So you could find
your sister. Powerful. I was doing my job. I could see my sister. I was looking after her. But then I was completely devastated when she disappeared.
So the strongest memory you have is of a job that you were given to do that along the way you thought you'd done badly because you'd lost her.
I totally failed, yeah.
Okay. You had totally failed to do your job that your mother had given you. Can you tell us, did you have a panda or teddy that you were able to take into hospital when you were four?
I did have a panda. I almost certainly took it to hospital because I took it everywhere at that age. But I don't remember if he was there. I mean, my sister probably had a doll, but I was too young to remember these details.
Great. Pete, that's extremely helpful. Thank you for being so open. And I'm trying to help us to think about the terror of a four-year-old. And in a second, we're going to come back to your story as a seven-year-old. Because one of the things that you and Rosa have in common is that you have been in hospital each more than once. But before we come back to your story as a seven-year-old, Shelley, can I come back to you? What does it feel like to hear Pete's experience of being a child in hospital, who's the same age as part of the time that your Rosa has been in hospital? What's that like to hear?
It's heartbreaking, really. I mean, when Rosa was in hospital, you know, thinking about how scary it was for her and how unfamiliar everything was and, you know, times when we weren't right next to her and so on, just, you know, it feels awful. And what Pete's describing is just, you know, that sort of stuff, but hugely more so. It's just, yeah, I mean, now it just doesn't bear thinking about that you would allow a child to go through that much hurt, and, you know, such a young child as well. Four is just tiny. You know, so yeah, it's really horrific.
Shelley, did you have any idea that at some point in our history, this would have been children's experience in a hospital?
I mean, I certainly knew that, you know, the sort of modern approach is very different to how it used to be. But no, I didn't know and I didn't appreciate just how different. I think I would have thought that lots of things that are thought of proactively now wouldn't have been thought about. So, you know, maybe children wouldn't be listened to in the same way. People wouldn't think about, you know, how do we embed children's rights in things? How do we get children's views involved in designing a building? I would have thought, you know, all of that stuff wouldn't have happened. But it wouldn't have occurred to me that children who were already in a scary situation would be treated cruelly.
Shelley, you've just used a really powerful word. Did we all just hear you say children would have been treated cruelly?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, Pete, it's your story, but to me, that sounds cruel, all of it. You know, the not being able to have your mum visit more than once a week for a couple of hours sounds cruel. And the, you know, having your sister, being separated from your sister and nobody giving you any explanation or any of that does sound cruel.
Shelley, I'm very grateful to you for using such a strong word because it helps us to think about, is that what it was like? Could staff have done such things to children without knowing? Could we be cruel to children unintentionally without realizing? Because though the stories of the past help us to see that more clearly now, but if you couldn't see it then, maybe there are things now that we can't see where we're harming children without meaning to. And I'm going to come back to you, Pete. First, can I ask, what does it feel like to hear Shelley use strong words to reflect on your experience? What does the word cruel feel like?
It makes sense to me, but at the time, it was normal. And okay, I was unfamiliar with hospital routine. I didn't understand what was going on. I had a job to do, and I was frustrated in that. I think I was a nuisance, which is why eventually they let me see my sister. But I didn't really understand what was going on. And people in authority, I mean, nurses and doctors are in authority, and they are saying, you know, you cannot go out of the room. You have to use this bottle too if you need a wee. It's a world that you're totally, you don't know what you, how you can, all you can do is follow the instructions, but no one is comforting you at all. Maybe Panda was comforting me.
Pete, it's really powerful. You help us to look at what once happened to our children, that perhaps no one meant to be cruel, but they could have been simply because of what was normal. So you've told us about when you were 4. Can you tell us about what happened when you were 7? Because you can remember that more clearly, and that will give more details for Shelley to think about what once happened in hospital. So tell us some of what happened for you when you were 7. Like, how long were you in for, and did you have Panda with you that time?
Right. Well, I think the timing is probably around about 1954, because it was between my transition from infant school to primary school. I think I was a few weeks late starting primary school because I had been in hospital.
Okay.
I can't recall exactly how long I was in for. It might have been 6 weeks, but I think it could have been nearer 3 months. There was no calendar. I had no idea how long I was there for at all. What happened was I woke up one night desperate to go to the toilet, and I didn't make it. I collapsed and I passed out. And eventually my parents must have I don't know what happened or how fast, but eventually I was carted off back to the same hospital.
Okay.
It's probably important that this hospital was an old isolation hospital, and it was in London. I think I was probably told what was wrong with me, but I don't think I understood what that meant. I took Panda with me, fortunately, and the first thing that happened, he was taken away from me. He was taken away from me. And I didn't get him back until the very last day when I was discharged. And the doctor, young doctor at the time, proudly pointed out that Panda had been in the wars, and he showed me the stitches around Panda's bottom and pointed out that Panda too had been through some kind of trauma. Basically, they'd taken the stuffing out of him and sterilized it. So I was, the whole time I was there, I didn't have my, what do you call it, Suzanne?
Your transitional object, your comfort.
I didn't have my transitional object with me. But I have never been able to throw Panda away. Every time I get to throw him away, I think, well, no, maybe I'll show him to my children, and then maybe I'll show him to my grandchildren, and I don't know who looks the worst of wear, Panda or me.
So you've brought Panda with you tonight, haven't you? So he's here, for those who are listening.
He's here supporting me.
Brilliant.
Do you want me to say something about the routine of family members coming?
Yes, please, Pete. That would be really helpful, because it contrasts with what Shelley and Rosa and...
Let's say 3 months. In the whole 3 months, only one person in my family came to see me. And she was allowed to come once a week on a Saturday for 2 hours. and bring sweets and colouring books. I couldn't read at that age. And I didn't see any of the rest of the family. The reason for that was possibility of infection. So I never saw my sister, I never saw my brother, I never saw my father in that whole period.
Okay.
And you want me to say something when I was discharged?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
I was moved from my room in the last week or two into a smaller room which had no windows. Previously, I could look out and I could see the flowers growing in the flower beds. So there was no room. I mean, there was no windows in the room I was in. And for some reason or other, a new nurse, or new to me, and they rotated the nurses all the time anyway, so I never knew the name of any nurse. But the one that used to give me bed baths, I don't know, once a day or whatever, didn't like me, treated me roughly. And I was so terrified of her that I learnt what I now know is to dissociate.
Yes.
I told myself I was dead, so I couldn't feel anything. And that way I could endure whatever she said or did to me. And it was very useful at the time, but I didn't realise I carried that ability right through my life, the ability to suddenly dissociate and not feel anything.
So, Pete, can we jump ahead in your story just for a second?
Yeah.
Because what you've just said is very powerful and very insightful. How old were you when you began to realize that you had learned these emotional skills out of terror and they'd lasted into your adulthood? How old were you when you began to make sense of the impact of your hospital experience?
Well, we're talking about 1954. I would say I didn't really get insights until 1982 when I had my first breakdown.
Go on, tell us a bit more.
Well, in my life, I've been admitted to psychiatric hospital 6 times.
Okay.
I deduced the first time that something had happened to me and I couldn't figure out what it was that had set off this series of traumas, and I did to it was basically break down and give up. I can't cope. But it did occur to me in the first breakdown that it was probably something that happened to me when I was very young, but I couldn't figure out what it might have been.
The medical staff who would have been supporting you in that first breakdown, they didn't help you to work out that it might have been the hospital? That wasn't part of their awareness?
On all the occasions I was in psychiatric hospital, no one ever asked or thought about or talked to me about what had happened to me. They were interested in making a diagnosis and then giving me the appropriate pills. So basically, and this is in the 1980s onwards, they see their job as basically dispensing pills to cope with whatever symptoms you're manifesting. So I was probably diagnosed at least 6 different things by 6 different consultants. And I think all these things are probably related. And I think more and more that they're related to what happened to my childhood. And I think they may be related to my periods of hospitalization.
So how old were you when you finally began to work out that the hospital experience had had a lasting impact? How old were you?
I don't think I could term it trauma until I got to my 60s. And even then, I thought trauma is probably overstating it. And it was only after you introduced me to the works of Robertson, and I started reading what he was saying about the impact of children going to hospital. And I would read it, that this child went to hospital for 5 days and they would talk to us. 5 days? I was in for 3 months. What are you talking about? And then I realised, of course, this, that at the time, in the 50s, my own brother was in a tuberculosis sanatorium for children for 2 years, but he was in a dormitory. But he was away from home for 2 years. And at the same time he was away, my father was in a sanatorium, an adult one, for tuberculosis. So there was a period before they both came back where both my brother and my father were complete strangers to my sister and me. Now, that has to have some effect.
Pete, you help us to start to think about the wider social context in which hospital care is created and policies are decided on and practice is deemed normal. You really helped us to start to think about what is happening in a particular time period. And your mother, in coming to visit, you would have had to be on the bus. You probably didn't have a car. It would have been far to travel. It would have been expensive. So we can start to look out more broadly about how care is framed. And Pete, I'm going to come back to your story in just a minute, okay?
Yep.
Because there are more elements of it which will help to bring it alive. But I'm going to pause just for a moment. And Shelley, I'm going to come back to you, please. And I'm just going to ask the same question. What does it feel like to hear what Pete is describing? What does it make you think about the kind of care Rosa received now? What do you find yourself thinking about in hearing that story?
I think just the huge contrast with the whole way this is approached and understood now. So like when Rosa was in hospital, the children's hospital charity has a hub within the hospital itself, and so they provide loads of, you know, activities. They, for kids who are in longer, I know they've got, they're involved in like providing education. You know, you can go and sit, and lots of times we would go down and they would say to me or my husband, oh, you sit and we'll make you a cup of tea and we'll go play, we'll play with Rosa over here. And so just that kind of sense that, you know, the child and the family need that support, and they need life to still be about more than just sitting being in hospital. So, and Rosa was in for Christmas and New Year and her birthday, and like the number of presents that she got from various bits of the hospital. And you know, at Christmas they have all these activities. In fact, one of our memories at Christmas, because obviously it was a hard Christmas, but we were still in the hotel in the hospital, and Rosa's brother, who's now eight, was eight at the time, came in and he was staying with us overnight in the hospital. He was staying with his grandparents most of the time during all of this stuff. And we hadn't realised they were lighting the Christmas tree. So there was this Christmas music, and I'm still, you know, just a nice memory in the midst of it all. We could see the tree from right outside our hotel window. So myself and my husband and our son just kind of standing, watching and listening to the songs and so on. And okay, Rosa wasn't with us, but she was close by because that was the point of the hotel. So, and yeah, you know, Santa comes round and all of this, and New Year, you know, I think this was the Children's Hospital Charity, came round with kind of little boxes with things. So Rosa, there was sort of wee sensory things and bits and pieces. So I think it's just that sense that a child isn't, you know, just this little thing that you can pop over here into hospital and forget about, and they can have nothing of the rest of their life. It's just, which feels like what Pete was describing, whereas with our experience, there was a lot of support to make sure that Rosa still had family and play and fun and, you know, development and all of that stuff. So, yeah, just so, so different.
Shelley, thank you. Your reactions, and this will be the first time you've heard Pete's story.
Yeah.
First time that Pete's heard Rosa's story. Your reactions help all of the listeners to think about how to frame Pete's experience, because you come from a place of real wisdom now, because you spent lots of time in hospital today. And so that lens that you have, that perspective, helps us to think even more deeply about what Pete is describing and about the importance of thinking about children's care and the long-term consequences. So one of the scary bits of thinking about this for many parents is, will there be long-term consequences of my child's time in hospital? And I think part of what your story is helping us to begin to understand is that if you don't have to bear the fear alone, if you have the people that you love around you, then it doesn't have to have the traumatic outcomes that otherwise it risks, that you have already told us about, Pete. So, Pete, could you just tell us about some of the other things that happened for you in hospital? Like, tell us the story of when you thought your mother was coming to visit, and then she didn't.
In the period when my mother was visiting, which was, I mean, if you're in hospital as a kid, it's the only thing to look forward to. Mum's coming on Saturday, and she'll be bringing me things. One time I can remember one of the young nurses got me out of bed, got me dressed. It was about the only time I ever got dressed in 3 months, and sat me on a chair by the window so I could watch my mum come up the drive, past the flower bed, and come and see me. And she never came. And that happened at least twice. So I went a fortnight without anybody coming to see me. And what I didn't know, and I didn't know until years later, is that both those times my mother had come and the staff had refused to admit her because it was inconvenient.
I'm leaving a pause so we can all think about that. So we can think about how a system frames a child's experience and leaves them with lasting consequences. I don't guess that the staff who wouldn't let your mother in, Pete, thought, and in 60-odd years' time, he'll still remember this. I reckon they just thought about what they needed at the moment, but they weren't able to keep in mind what that feels like to the child who is disappointed and distraught and living with the feeling of disappointment in his body that his mother's forgotten him. Pete, am I right? Do you think disappointment came to like live in your body really strongly as a consequence of these experiences?
I guess so. But I think it's worth mentioning some of the other things that were more immediate at the time.
Okay.
So I've already mentioned that I came out of hospital with an ability to dissociate at any time if the pressures were too great. I also came out with, I think, a distrust of adults.
Okay.
They would always let you down. I mean, my family didn't. I think there's a feeling that you can't trust people. It's not, once you've been through those sort of experiences, you're wary of people.
Sure.
But the other things I came out with were I started bedwetting, which I'd never done before. I developed a stutter, which took several years to go away. And I came away with whooping cough, which I caught off one of the nurses. And the final thing is, because I'd been in bed so long, I actually couldn't stand up or walk. So I came out of the wheelchair and was given crutches.
Wow.
So I probably ditched the crutches after a couple of weeks. But I was emaciated. I was way underweight for years. And I was a sort of pathetic little kid, really. I got bullied at school.
Yep.
Took a long time to forget all that stuff and to actually grow into a different person.
Of course, what we now know from trauma is that although we may consciously forget things, our body doesn't forget. The memory of it lives in our body and it shapes how we function emotionally and how we cope with stress. And that can all be done unconsciously. So, Pete, tell us the story about when you're 10 and you're having terrible nightmares, if you would, please.
I tend to forget that because they seem to be unrelated. But about the age of 10, I started waking up. I shared a room, a bedroom with my brother, and I would wake up. This was probably, I think it's probably before I went to secondary school. I
Okay.
think it probably was. But basically, I started waking up screaming, and I couldn't be stopped screaming. And I had a sensory feeling that I was brittle and that my bones would break if I touched something. And everything felt like, even a book would feel like it was one sheet of paper. Everything felt fragile. And I would scream, 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 wake the whole house up. And it would probably take half an hour to calm me down. So they recommended I go and see a psychiatrist, which I don't think I ever did. But my GP put me on phenobarbital, which is a pretty heavy duty thing. And I was medicated every day on phenobarbital for 6 years. And it gradually, the amount that I was prescribed went down from one pill, two pills, down to a bit, to a quarter. And then after 6 years, I was weaned off phenobarbital. So when it came, when that, this is when the time, that age, I was 16. This is where the drugs start. There's pushers in the school. Everybody's popping drugs. I was totally resistant. No one could make me take any kind of medication, which is one good thing. But I didn't really know what it did to me and how it affected me. And no one ever explained anything about anything that happened to me. I now have had the privilege of accompanying my own children to hospital. I recognize so much of what Shelley says in the way that my children were treated, but it was a different world for me.
Pete, that's said incredibly powerfully. I'm kind of imagining what lots of listeners might be doing with that story. For all of you who are listening, if you find yourself like you're kind of clutching at your chest or your heart, thinking about the details of what we've just heard, I'm really grateful because that means you are willing to think about children's pain rather than close down to it, which is what happened for so many of the staff that you're describing, Pete. So let me ask one more question at this point. Did we just hear you say that no one ever talked to you about what happened in hospital and what it was like? And like, so what happened when you came home? Did your parents talk about what it had been like and help you to make sense of that time?
No, it never happened. And I checked with my sister last week, and she agreed that our experiences of hospital were never discussed. It was, I mean, my parents, my grandparents had just been through the Blitz. People were dying. Family members were in the services and were at risk of being killed. What happens to kids in hospital is trivial. I mean, the answer, of course, is that whatever anybody does, my parents were always supportive, but they were not in the habit of discussing things the way we do now. But there's one key thing I would say for every kid. Always have your panda with you.
Always have your panda with you and t talk to children about what their experiences are so they can make sense of them. What the trauma literature tells us now, all that science, is that it doesn't matter so much what happens to you. What matters is, one, is there anyone there to help you with the feelings about it? And two, in the talking about your feelings, do people help you to make sense of what happened? And what you have told us a story about, Pete, is a dramatic, scary, cruel story, to use Shelley's strong language, that no one ever helped you to make sense of. And so you carry that with you into your adulthood with lifelong consequences. Shelley, what does it feel like to keep thinking about this? Like anything, because you help us to realize the power of the changes that have happened when lots of people don't ever remember that it was possible for children to have the experience that Pete did. Just keep telling us what you find yourself thinking about as you hear that story and you compare it to Rose's experience, please.
I mean, I guess partly I was thinking about it. So after this most recent episode with Rosa, she definitely was affected by it. So she's pre-verbal, she has Down syndrome, so she can't articulate how she's feeling in the same way. But there were a good few months it took her to sort of come back to being her full self again. And what you were saying, Pete, about like the sort of physical impact as well. So she similarly, she couldn't sit up, and then she couldn't walk, and she couldn't, it took a long time to get back up to full kind of strength and energy and all of that stuff. So I guess, I mean, these things have a huge impact on a child, I think, because of the ways in which she was supported through that, and the fact that we do now talk about these things, and even though, she's not verbal, we still have tried to help her kind of process through these things. So we realized actually she had to go back for very, very regular X-rays for a while, and the first time was fine, and then the second time she just absolutely was not having it. She was so upset, more upset than she ever normally gets. And so we realized that we hadn't told her that this was a thing that wasn't going to hurt. And so many of the things that she's had done to her in hospital, she got to the stage where anyone would come near her, and she was just didn't want anything to do with them because everything that people were doing hurt.
Yeah.
And realized that we had to, when we were going for an X-ray, we needed to say to her, this is not sore, this won't hurt, all of this sort of stuff. So I think even, we do talk about these things, but we still underestimated how much we needed to help her understand and process and so on. But I don't, touch wood, I don't think that she'll be impacted in nearly the same way on a long-term basis. And that's a positive thing. Like that was, it did take a while, and it will have some impact, but not, just the idea that a child could go through all of that and just be left to then get on with life. It just nowadays it seems like, well, of course that's going to have a huge impact. You're going to take all of that with you, especially if you've had such little care taken of you through that experience, and then no support afterwards to make sense of it, or even to just acknowledge what a big impactful thing it was. What you were saying, Pete, about being in your 60s before you actually connected, some of what had happened subsequently with those early experiences. It would seem crazy to think that those experiences, as you described them, wouldn't have a huge impact on you.
Shelley, thank you. I love the really big way in which you describe the thinking about that, contemplating that a child could have all of those experiences and then just being left to get on with it because their parents weren't helped to know the importance of talking about it and helping to process it, which gives us some sense of how much change there's been. So let me just, for anyone who's listening and doesn't know the story, let me just remind us how we got the kind of change that let you and Rosa and your family have a really different experience, Shelley, from Pete and his family. By the late 1940s, psychologists were already worried about this standard way of treating children in hospitals, where parents weren't allowed to visit. Psychologists that would grow into what became known as attachment theory understood this was probably not great for children. And they tried to talk to the medical staff and the hospital managers about why they thought parents should be allowed to stay. And one of the people who was a real leading voice in that is the man that you named, Pete, earlier, was James Robertson. who was a psychiatric social worker, and he simply said, we should let parents stay. And what he found was that it was too hard for the medical staff to hear him say that. They felt insulted. They felt like their professional integrity was impugned. They worried that it would allow germs. They thought that parents who wanted to stay with their children were neurotic and overplaying the situation. They believed that children, once they finally stopped crying, had settled down. They didn't really know about dissociation. When Robertson and his colleagues tried to create change, they met a lot of resistance. So one of the key things that Robertson is known for now is that in 1952, he made a film called When a Two-Year-Old Goes to Hospital, which tried to show these emotional consequences of going to hospital and how a child shuts down and becomes scared and distrusting, as you described it, Pete. And so he felt confident that this film would help doctors and nurses to see, but he was wrong. What he discovered was that it sent them into a total uproar, and he had to withdraw that film, which he saw as a scientific illustration. He had to withdraw it from general release in order to help medics to walk more slowly into that film. Now, when I'm training, I often show a clip from that film. Anybody can Google and go see a clip from that film of a little girl named Laura in this film, struggling to cope with the absence of her mother. And that film was used well into the 1970s, often to train social workers. But nowadays, it's often forgotten. And yet, it's still a really powerful piece of film. And sometimes now I think about the film Resilience, which many listeners may have heard and or seen, because that was shown in lots of places in Scotland in 2017, 18, 19, 2020, which was another film that helped people to think about children's experiences. So films can be really powerful. But the interesting thing about Robertson's film is that as powerful as it is, it was too uncomfortable for the medics to see. And so as I wind up that story, Robertson and lots of colleagues kept working very, very hard to have people to think more closely about the kind of care children needed. And some of the histories say it took four decades, before finally a hospital practice began to shift really significantly. In some places, it happened more quickly. And certainly by the 1960s, more hospitals were letting parents stay. By the 1970s, there was more conversation going on about this. But some histories say that it took four decades before hospital care for children really shifted significantly. And Shelley, what that means is if you're Rosa, had been in hospital only a few decades ago, you might not have been able to see her as often, or you might not have had those play therapists or Christmas lights. And so understanding this shift, I think, is really powerful in helping us to think about care today. Shelley, what does that story that I've just told make you think about? I know I keep asking you that question, but how does it lead you to reflect on what your experience was in, you know, in 2022?
I think one of the things is that our experience has been, you know, hugely positive. And I'm enormously grateful to, was it James Robertson you said? Sorry, the child, enormously grateful to him and the other people who got us, you know, through very hard work. Got us to where we are now instead of where we used to be. I think you can still, even now, you can see little kind of almost sort of echoes maybe of some of the resistance. So in our experiences, for example, it's quite often been that sort of slightly a different approach from nurses as compared to other medics, for example, there's just a slightly different culture, I think, sometimes in the way that they sort of respond to you. We had an instance when Rose was a baby and she was medically ready to be discharged. She was 3 weeks old. She hadn't met most of the people in her family because she'd been in hospital for the first 3 weeks and so on. And we were kind of all set to go, and we really needed to be at home. That was the tipping point, was that that would be much better for us. And we were going to be kept in the hospital over another weekend for the convenience of somebody who wanted a particular scan, and it couldn't be done till the Monday. And it was actually the charge nurse who sent us out for a little walk, and we came back, and she was like, "Right, would you like to go home?" Because she had just said to the clinicians in that case, "No, you're these this family needs to go home. You're not keeping them here. They can come back as an outpatient for the scan, you know, blah blah blah." So she was very kind of, she came from it from our perspective and from, you know, what was right for us as a family, and didn't believe that we just sort of had to fit into the system and convenience of, you know, medics and the system and so I think for me, like, there's just little echoes of that thing of, for people who are working in healthcare, I mean, it's hard to know how to say this because I have such huge respect and gratitude towards people who have supported and saved my girl's life. But there's just this thing sometimes of, it's kind of their domain, and you and your child are in their domain. You and your child are kind of in their workplace. So very occasionally there have been tiny things, like there was one particular nurse in one of the wards that Rosa was in. There was just tiny things which were about her kind of keeping the power, and you felt, you know, you weren't allowed to have this information or this bit of control or whatever. And so I understand all of that because it's quite human, but I just think, and I'm not like, it pales into insignificance really with what Pete's describing, but there's just little echoes, I think, of some of that resistance that comes up when people are trying to kind of change cultures and yeah.
So, Shelley, I really like that you have been able to find some of those links, because Pete used the word inconvenience earlier and you've used it again. So that makes me think of the last question that I'm going to ask each of you, right? Shelley, you have just said you've helped us to think about the importance of thinking about children's and families' experience always, even when you're in the midst of someone else's workplace, because it's easy to get pulled into the idea of convenience and forget about the experience that you're going to be carrying home with you as a family member and as a child. That's a really important insight. So I'm going to end by asking each of you, what would you like listeners to take away from this? That might be the public, it might be parents, it might be healthcare workers, nurses, doctors, orderlies. What is one key insight that you would really like people to take away from the stories that you've been willing to share?
I think that the most valuable thing for a child is to know that they are loved. And one manifestation of that, and I'll just demonstrate, my panda says hello to Rosa's panda, and Rosa, remember that whatever is happening, if you're feeling scared, if you're feeling worried, if it hurts, panda will always be there to comfort you. And to the rest of you, I say you can substitute panda, you can substitute your teddy. But the same applies. Your teddy will always be there for you.
Pete, that's lovely. I love that you've chosen to speak to children even before the adults, and to help us to really think about the importance of comfort. Thank you. Shelley, what's a key thing you would like people to take away?
I don't think I can come up with something as lovely as what Pete just said, but I think it's just trying to remember that sometimes the way that children experience things is, it can be much bigger than how we as an adult might experience them, and that really matters. So This is actually this isn't thinking from Rosa's perspective per se, but so Rosa was in over Christmas, over New Year, over her birthday, and so on. And all of this experience impacted her brother a lot. And he is older and he's able to articulate a bit more. And it's taken a lot of support to kind of get him to terms with it. But one of the things he was really upset about all of this one night at bedtime. And one of the things he said to me was, Mum, Rosa was in hospital for a year, a whole year. And I said, well, she was in for a long time, but it wasn't a year. It was just the 7 weeks. And he said, no, she was, it was Christmas, and then it was a new year, and then it was her birthday. He to this day is adamant that she was in hospital for a full year. And like to me, that I would never have thought that to him he experienced this as she was in hospital for a year. He was not living with us at the time, he was with his grandparents, and his life was hugely disrupted. So I think it's that makes me just remember that I think as an adult, it's so easy to overlook how children experience things and the fact that things are different, time is different, feelings are different, so many things are different. And so I think for anybody listening, it's just always trying to remember that and not take for granted that, a child is experiencing something in a small way when maybe they're actually experiencing it in a really big way.
My life. Amazing. My life.
My life.
Amazing.
My life.
My life.
With amazing.
My life.
Amazing. Strangers.
Wonderful. Well, it's just left for me to say thank you to you, Pete. Shelley, thank you very much indeed. And I hope we do get permission to share those pandas because they are fantastic. And Dr. Suzanne Zizek, thank you for another fantastic episode of My Life with Amazing Strangers. Fierce curiosity. And that's our second. I look forward to our third. Wherever you are in the world today listening to this podcast, thank you for your time. Take care of yourself and each other. In the word of some famous American show host once upon a time, regardless, you take care. Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.